Dear boy. Yeah, wait a minute here. Oh, yeah. I'm checking out the equipment here. We built this transmitter, for those of you who are curious of the technical aspects of our station here. It was made from a Heath kit. And we got this got this 9-year-old kid with a soldering iron build it for us. Works pretty good, you know. Well, he's cheap labor, and he's fast, yes. Oh, my, George. It's spring, you know, and my head is turned to a nest of robins, and like the oriole, I'm flying south for something. You know, speaking of spring, let's you mind if I indulge myself today? I mean, really indulge myself. Now, I know that there's a lot of you are going to say, oh, not that again. Well, then you can just get right on down the dial and find something you like, right? And no skin off my thing. Would you please give me a little cheap guitar music? There's a guy I know wrote a poem about baseball, and I know it's called The Great Mississippi. Up from the grasslands, the plains, the cities, up from the vastness of the land itself, up, up, up to the Great Mississippi. Up to that first field, bathed in sun, basking in the glory of its birth, immersed in future time. Further up slides the sun, up to the Red Stockings from Cincinnati, the original magnificent machine, the dynasty without a future, up to the National Association, swaying in its greatness. Further up slides the sun. Through the mouth of history slide provocative names once breathed on the lips of dreamers. In what fine grave do the Elizabeth Resolutes, the Troy Haymakers, and the Lord Baltimores now rest? Names of great ball teams. Isn't that a great name? The Elizabeth Resolutes, the Troy Haymakers, and the Lord Baltimores. Up, moving up to expanding cities, pocketed in gray concrete. Can you hear the shrill and melodic chant of the train conductor calling out his roll? New York, Hartford, Boston, Philadelphia, Louisville, Cincinnati, Chicago, and St. Louis, up, 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 up to the Great Mississippi. That was the first stanza called The Great Mississippi. It was the birth of baseball. Now the Grand Central Hotel, no sun. Now rubble, the collected debris of memories, echoes an anguished ring through the corridors of Manhattan canyons. Where are we going? From where to where do we step? December, a month, a day, a time, bogged on the fresh pages of history, the first and only real entry, a league, a new league, a microscopic legion of men bearing witness to the birth, unfurling its colors on an industrial land to detract from the former failure, the National League is dead. Long live the National League. From rubble to rubble, from dust to dust, new fortresses stretch their fledgling arms and puncture the sky with abbreviated zeal, like so many transients awaiting a derailed train. The others come and never go. The American Association is dead. The Union Association is dead. The Players League is dead. All gone, all dead. Long live the National League. Stanza 3, the American League. Do you like this? It's beautiful. After the rubble, the dust, the coat of dust hovering over sidewalks into the cracks of time, dust races in the sunlight, fresh footprints, permanent steps on the floor of history, the steps of giants, of circus performers, and golden-armed magicians traipsing through the sun-filled cities and sunless nights in search of permanence. Brave Mac, Cornelius Alexander McGillicuddy Mac, Mac the Master. The tall, lean visionary who led a white elephant and, of course, notwithstanding, not without, in center ring, the acrobat from Georgia. The acrobat who spelled his name capital C, little O, little B, little B. The frenzied acrobat who danced on the wall of greatness with razor feet, who cut his image in swirls of blood. Oh, the sawdust stained with blood, the dripping pattern of immortal footprints imprinted on the souls of ordinary men, dust races in the sunlight, but the sun cannot speak. 1919. Before the threat and dismal cold gray of morning came the sun, and Charlie Comiskey should have turned in his sleep, should have turned in his sleep, should have turned. Insane sun floating above the earth like some extravagant madman spending next year's allowance. The same burning sun. The same afternoons in all the cities, east and somewhat west of the great Mississippi, should have turned in his sleep. Too many suns and too many cities, too many faces. In the face of it all, how much grief, too much grief. Too many fates, too many suns, far too many of too many things, far too many of too many things. Should have turned in his sleep. More like Dolly, Lex Victoria. The playing field becomes a landscape fixed and isolated and trapped between the borders of its own fabrication. The stadium faces blur in the afternoon sun. The celebration ends in the afternoon sun. The victory becomes defeat in the afternoon sun. Morality. Victoria escaped. Insane sun. How much of how many things? The death of honor. The end of a fading and final thrust should have turned in his sleep. And says, the unsettling dust settles in the throat of all men. There are not enough beers in all the bars in all the worlds to flush out the stale bitterness of too many afternoons, of too many suns. And Charlie Comiskey woke up and deposited the nightmare in the pillow of his dream. That's 1919, the Black Sox, you know the story. Listen to this beautiful stanza. This is called The Babe. Jovial giant, squashed between greatness and an empty childhood, juxtaposed in time and play. Mirthmaker, charmer, crowd pleaser, lover, king. A crown of gold, a golden crown, a golden statue of gold. We toast you with gauntlets of gold and crown you with our passion. We celebrate your proud head, tipped upward and framed by a golden sun. My daddy did, and his laugh and such sound could reach your ears. Your sound... Wait a minute, let me see, where am I at here? Yeah, the babe. Here we go. My daddy did, and his laugh, if ever such a sound could reach your ears, would be filled with the loud and quiet joy that men such as Mays and Robinson and Aaron could have given him. Not their booming home runs and feats of magic. Just their faces. Just their faces. Here's what he says about Hank Aaron. This is called number 714. On the 21st of July, Henry Aaron slapped home run number 700 and smiled in the quiet way in which he smiles. On the 17th day of August, Henry Aaron slapped home run number 703 and wondered if his wrist would not give way and cheat him. On the third day of September, Henry Aaron slapped home run number 707, slapped home run number 708, and thought of the stars. On the 17th day of September, Henry Aaron slapped home run number 711 and said it wasn't important anymore. There was time. On the 22nd day of September, Henry Aaron slapped home run number 712 and wondered if nature understood the struggle of men. The sun is awesome and does not compromise. On the 29th day of September, Henry Aaron slapped home run number 713 and forgot all the cruelty sent by mail. A child walks to the edge of the water and efforts in the sand of the afternoon sun to save stale castles too illiterate to fall. On the 30th day of September, Henry Aaron singled three times and then went home to wait the summer. That was, of course, written. This was written before he hit number 714, which he hit on opening day. Talk about fantastic poetic drama. He hit it on his first swing of the year. Pop. Out over that left center field wall, gone. Beyond the Great Mississippi, this is called. After St. Louis, we crowded our caravans and headed west, uncautiously moving toward the sun. Moved until we reached the waters of the Pacific, until we seeded unknown soil. And some of the seedlings took, and some died. This is expansion. Moved southward and even northward beyond familiar borders, and the land which once selfishly nestled its offspring in limited embrace now extended its arms to all who chanced the journey, and the sun no longer shone in the same afternoons in the same cities. Nice. It's a real nice thing. Jordan Deutsch. Simply called. Simply called The Great Mississippi, dedicated to an old friend of mine, Lee Allen. Hold it there. You know that, there is something mystical about the opening of baseball season. It's nothing to do much with the sport, although it has a lot to do with the sport. Hard to describe what it is. If you don't understand what it is, ain't no way I can ever explain it to you. No way. I guess it's also very much associated with the time of year. You know, spring. And I think we're very much part of the animal kingdom. Man is. And as such, we're subjected to a lot of things we don't even know about. Like, for example, it is a fact that animals are different in different times of the year. They really are. If you've ever known a horse, for example, a horse without knowing why will suddenly start growing a thick coat of fur before the winter, right, Jim? Absolutely. And he doesn't control it. It just starts to grow. And without even any likewise warning, there's a certain time of the year when he sheds his winter coat. And did you know that this is the name of an Indian month? The moon of pony shedding its coat, which is a great name for a moon. And then they had another moon, the moon of the thick pony coat, meaning the month when the pony really showed that thick coat. What month would you figure that would be, roughly? You as a horse owner, Jim. Well, see, I think to Americans, of course, when that first ball is thrown out and that first swing and the first scores start coming in, this doesn't mean much. Sport, I'm sorry, if you don't like sport, that's like saying, look, because I don't like flowers, I will not accept the fact that jonquils have anything to do with spring. It does not affect you. And I'm just sorry for people who have missed that curious kind of poetry. And I think some of the most poetic books on sport, it's interesting, have been invariably written about baseball. Baseball has something that none of the other sports have. What it is, it's hard to determine. Difficult to put on. And it's a mixture of things. It's hard to remember past football players. It really is, no matter how great they were. You know, the name there, you just forgot. But somehow, names of ball players and the way they were and the way they moved remain forever with you. Even if you've only seen a couple of games, it's hard to describe why. Maybe because baseball is essentially a lonely game. And it is, I mean, for players. For people sitting in the stands, no. But for players, it's a game of long stretches of lone contemplation. And if you've ever played any outfield at all, you know exactly what I'm talking about. That sun beating down on your back. And you look down into the blue, curious, cave-like, mysterious blackness of the stands down way far off in the distance, and you see other people down there doing things that could affect you drastically any second. And there's a kind of a pastoral quality about it, which has to be felt to be explained. Chewing grass. All outfielders, by the way, are veteran grass eaters. You know, speaking of springtime, I mean, the spring doesn't mean as much in New York as it does in the rest of the country, and for one reason. New York is definitely insulated from weather. New York is like living in some kind of big concrete cube, and a concrete cube that is curiously muted. Spring, summer, winter, fall, they come very subtly and gradually. The only indication you got that spring really has arrived in New York is you'll see that the cab driver will change from his checkered wool shirt to a checkered cotton shirt. That's about it, you know. Yeah, that's about all. You know, you have to watch the plumage of the natives carefully to tell the difference. But out in the great vast country that we live in, spring usually heralds a time of madness, because spring is a moment of real jubilation. It goes deep into the heart of the animal that we are. You know that that animals have a tremendous energy in the springtime. And if animals ever celebrate, it's in the spring. And you know why? Because they have survived another winter. Nature recognizes this. Winter is a great killing time for animals, and that's the truth, man. And when that first soft air comes down over the hill and the first blades of grass start popping up through the soil, man, that's time for jubilation. Many a bear, you know, does not wake up after its long winter hibernation. You aware of this? Oh, yes. That's quite right. Many a deer does not live to see another April, because of that cold wind and the heavy snow. And so man is much like this. Man celebrates, man, deep inside, when that springtime, because you've made it again. You have made it again. It's a great sense of deep animal satisfaction. The sun beams down, and there's the anticipation of a summer. And also the vague disappointment that's already built into you, the feeling that you're going to boot this summer like you booted others. All the great stuff that you have planned in your mind. You know, it'll be already September in about 2 weeks. And you're going to wonder, what the hell? I never did get to the beach. I never did do all that stuff. And so there's a frantic two-pronged attack on summertime that people always feel in their mind. One, it's regret. And the other, it's celebration. Hard to determine which is the most important. But I'll tell you one thing, and you just saw it in the news, man. Springtime means a lot of things in different parts of the country. And the part of the country that I come from, springtime is a time when the winter, which has always tough compared to anything in New York, some are not as tough as others, this, you know, the winter. I'm talking about the Great Plains states. I'm talking about Illinois, which is a plains state. I'm talking about Indiana, which is one of the states of the Great Plains. That at this time of the year, and there is one other time, too, when it happens, but at this time of the year, there is that brooding fear of the tornado. Did you see the picture of the guy on the front page of the Times, this morning's Times, just standing enigmatically with the wreckage around him? It says, town remains calm in midst of devastation. That couldn't happen in New York. New York, if a tornado ripped down 6th Avenue and just continued, you know, from Central Park right down 6th Avenue, across 57th Street, across 34th Street, across 23rd Street, and then finally turned right at 14th Street and headed for the river, this town would be in a state of shock, because we wouldn't expect it. But guys who live in certain parts of the Midwest always expect it. Even if they've never been hit, they expect it. And I have been in 3 tornadoes, personally, 3. And once you've been in a tornado, there's no really adequate way to describe it to people. There just simply isn't. It has nothing to do with any other kind of storm. So if you think of a hurricane you've been in Florida or something like that, or maybe over in the Jersey coast, you have to completely drive that out of your mind when you're talking about a tornado. The only thing that I can parallel a tornado with is a stick of high explosive bombs being laid in a line by a plane, because it has an explosive force. It does not have a cumulative force. If you're in a hurricane, it's an accumulated wind. It's a heavy wind, but it blows steadily. And it's just a big, heavy wind is what a hurricane is, often with driving rain. But it's a big, heavy wind. But this is not true of a tornado. A tornado may cover only an area of about 50 feet, across. It just maybe even less, sometimes 20 feet, 50 feet. But this thing is like some kind of a giant machine gun that just moves right down. And then it'll go. It's like a great tongue. You know, that I talked to a tornado expert, a guy that spent his entire life studying tornadoes. He's a meteorologist. Had never seen one. You can go out for years in Kansas and always just miss them. you can't plan on them. And just by chance, in one short period in my life, in about 2 years, I was involved in 3 tornadoes that I saw, and it's an unbelievable sight, the tornado. It's like something is alive. It has a quality to it like some giant monster. You seen movies of them? When suddenly you see this big tongue coming down, well, they come down, you know. They suddenly lower. Well, the most terrifying, I've seen the one of them was off in the distance, but the 2 that I was close to were just you can't express what kind of power and force and terror they bring. And I'll tell you what happened to me. I'll just lay it out. I think I've told the story. 2 times in one summer, I was around tornadoes. And I this summer, I was working in the steel mill. I was a kid. I was about 16. I just got my working papers. And the steel mill, you understand, is like a giant city in itself. When you're working in the steel mill, especially in the job that I had, you cover a lot of ground in the mill, and you're alone a lot. And I was delivering mail. I had a big leather bag of mail, like a mailman's bag. And I was moving. I'd cover maybe 6-7 miles each time I ran my route delivering mail, which I ran 3 times a day. So, and you'd run constantly. And I had all little pathways that I would go in between this building and that building next to the 14-inch rolling mill. Then I'd cut through the 40-inch mill. Then I would go over to the plate mill office and down past the blast furnace office, past the slag scales and moving in and out. Well, I was moving along there concentrating, sorting my mail on this day. It was an ordinary day. That's something I have to tell you about tornadoes. They happen on totally ordinary days. It's not like there's a lot of thunder and a lot of lightning, a lot of rain, and then the tornado comes. That would be a warning. Oh, no. This was just an ordinary day. It wasn't particularly hot. It wasn't cold. It was spring, just like this. And I'm running along between 2 big corrugated iron buildings that had railroad tracks running between them. And the tracks were right up next to one building, and there was a string of freight cars standing on the track, right up against the building. You know, they were loading there or something. So I'm running along the freight cars, and up ahead of me I see this long line of high-tension poles, these great big, well, they weren't poles, high-tension towers, you know, the big metal towers with the big cross arm and the transformers and all that, and the buildings all around me. Well, I want to tell you, though, when I read this stuff here in the paper about the tornadoes, it hit me because they're so inexplicable. What famous story? Let's put you on your mettle here. What famous classical story begins, the opening chapter begins with a tornado? I'll tell you this: it's a children's book. Okay. Well, that's how common tornadoes are out there in that area. But when this baby hit, I was walking along between... You want to hear what happened to me? I was about 16 when the first tornado I ever was involved in hit. I was walking along between these two buildings, sorting my mail, you know, concentrating. See, I was putting the mail, I'll put the for the plate mail over at this end of the bag, and I'm walking along there. And all of a sudden, I heard from my right, from the direction of the freight cars. I was walking right along this line of freights. I heard a roar. Now, of course, you hear a lot of noise constantly in the steel mill. It's continually roaring. But this fantastic roar, it sounded like an explosion, sort of a boom. It just went like that. And without any warning, it just went boom. And I saw going over my head great strips of this corrugated iron building being stripped off, just like somebody's tearing cellophane, and zip, disappearing. What the heck's going on? I didn't feel any wind, but a great roar. And then I saw, directly ahead of me, I saw this high-tension tower start swaying. And I still didn't feel anything except to hear this enormous roar, and it was sort of surrounding me. It was getting bigger and bigger and roaring greater, and instinctively I threw myself to my right and grabbed the hull of the freight cars. You know, they had these metal ladders that go up the side of the freight cars, and I slammed up against the car and hung on. I thought it was an explosion. And at that point, the high-tension tower just toppled, just went, and as it did, all the great wires that were on it broke, began to tear off with tremendous flashes of flame as this high tension began to explode, you know, 30,000 volts up there, and a transformer, about a 2-ton transformer, just fell right off the top of one of the towers and spun end over end about 50 feet away from me and landed right on the top of a parked car that was sitting under it and just flattened it. The wheels just boom, and I couldn't imagine what the hell's happening. You know, I'm hanging on, and it was then that my mail disappeared. It was a wild thing. I had a whole bag of mail, and suddenly something sucked it, just like a giant monster sucking the bottom of a malted milk, you know, with the straw. It just went, boom, gone. I never saw my mail again. About 200 letters just went, gone. Well, this thing just went right past. I saw a big black shadow go past me, tremendous roar, and it was all over. This baby had cut a swath through the steel mill, and it had missed me about 50 feet, not more than 50 feet. There were 7 guys killed in less than 5 seconds in the mill to my left. Fantastic moment. It was gone as quickly as it came, left nothing in its wake except wrecks.